Jeffrey Jones. Many families have experienced incidents throughout the years that cannot be explained. Some call them paranormal or supernatural. Others may say that they were haunting, eerie, or weird. Whichever adjective is used, it is meant to say that the cause is unknown, the origin not understood. The fact that they are discussed in hushed tones many years later indicates that the unexplained nature of such occurrences may also have induced a subset of fear. This is the true account of one such happening. Three young boys huddled and shaking beneath the protective envelope of an old hand-spun quilt, staring fearfully at the frightening image of unknown monsters in the midst of their midnight bedroom, their minds screaming the question, "What are they?" The story opens on a small open platform of an Amtrak station in Aurora, Colorado. The year is 1965. The month is June. A mother carrying an infant hustles her five other children through the crowd towards the street beyond, and the anxious husband who has endured a five-month family separation in his quest to find a new homestead for his growing brood. A quest that is taking him from the industrial suburbia that was Detroit, Michigan, to the very footstep of the Rocky Mountains amidst the wide open sky surrounding the then modest skyline of Denver. Their new home is a typical bungalow nestled on a corner lot of a tree-lined street of an unpretentious neighborhood located just blocks from busy Stapleton Airport. Although small, the soundness of the structure and the expansive side yard set the scene for what should have been an idyllic lifestyle in an emblematic American city. The tranquil setting belies the activities that occurred there, and the horror survived by the participants of this devilish nightmare some 45 years ago. The hectic move-in procedures were no different from any other. The confused placement of boxes and other belongings just as frantic. The boys, being of no particular help, were free to explore their new surroundings in characteristic boyhood fashion, their attention immediately drawn to the garden shed, which sat along the back fence line. The few remaining yard tools left by the previous residents consisted of a couple of rakes, a shovel, and a small garden trowel which the boys used to explore a dirt mound in the otherwise overgrown side yard. A mound that would yield an unexpected windfall in the form of two small, innocent-looking molded plastic figurines of some unrecognizable prehistoric creatures, one green and the other yellow. Creatures that would in subsequent weeks rise from within their new home deep inside the boys' toy chest and assume an identity all their own. An identity of unrivaled, impish behavior that thrust itself in the nighttime realm of our unsuspecting young subjects. For the boys, began as an unexplained overnight upheaval of their bedroom, a disturbance that left most of their personal effects in disarray, scattered and thrown about the room, resulting in a disorder of unparalleled enormity. The parents did not believe their denial. The boys' punishment? To stand with their noses in a corner and to clean the room yet again. Night after night, the frenzy continued, while day after day, the penalty imposed. The boys began to suspect each other as the cause, and tensions arose between them. The oldest of the three was bullying in his demeanor of the two younger, knowing only that he had not been the reason for their shared plight, and feeling justified in the apportionment of his own brand of retribution. The younger two brothers each knew that they were not responsible for the commotion that ensued each evening either, neither had the ability of the Otis to displace the resentment in some other way. Therefore, a fortnight had continued. During this same period, other unnatural incidents affected other family members in uncanny yet similar ways. The middle of the three sisters, although only five, did on several occasions uncharacteristically fall down the steps from the bedrooms upstairs, once receiving injuries sufficient to render her unconscious. She claimed that she had felt a hand on her back, as though she had been pushed. Evidence was never produced to either prove or disprove her claim. An overactive imagination, or an outright lie, was always the conclusion of the aforementioned parents. The mother, too, experienced episodes of a peculiar nature. She often heard footsteps on the staircase in some late hour, and she would rush to see which of her children was up and sneaking about. She had so wanted to believe her three sons' protestations of innocence that she expected to find one of them roaming the house in a sleepwalking trance. She had hoped that this would also solve the mystery of the boys' bedroom clutter, but the stairs were always empty. On other occasions, the mother would suddenly wake from a deep sleep to see the shadowy figure of an unknown man standing at the foot of her bed. Though appearing to be non-threatening, the figure always brought with him a foreboding sense of discomfort. And he would fade away, leaving the mother to question if she had actually seen him at all. Although having all of the pieces of this mystical puzzle, the sum of the parts were never associated with each other, and the mystery never solved. In later years, the mother correlated the events experienced by all into a credible conjecture that the house had indeed had an affliction of supernatural origin. During the warm summer nights, the boys would sit for hours on the gently sloped roof of the front porch just outside their twin windows of the dormer in their bedroom. This afforded a perfect view of the giant jetliners on final approach to the airport, the faces of the weary travelers clearly visible through the portholes. They discussed the attributes of the aircraft, the possible origination of the flight, and the marvel of engineering being witnessed. They wondered if someday they too would experience the fascination of such phenomenal high-speed travel. On one such night during the lull between the arriving flights, they discussed something else too. It would seem that the boys, while having a shared experience in one aspect, had each individually recounted other frightful occurrences to each other. Occurrences with all too fearsome familiarity, one to another. Each gave an account of having awakened to the muffled sounds of some unknown movement just feet away in the early pre-dawn hours, and knowing too that his brothers were there with him, snuggled in the same full bed that they shared. Too terrified to look from beneath the protective cover, but also unable to ignore the temptation to peel back the cloak for one small peek. A glimpse into the dominion of the unexplained. A glimpse that would transform into an uncontrollable, disbelieving stare. What each had seen could not be described within the usual boundaries of normality. It is not normal to see the disfigured and disproportionate brightly colored life-size iconic representations of the two found figurines romping about the room. And yet there they were, brawling and struggling like two giant sumo wrestlers, displacing all in their path. seemingly locked in a great effort to each conquer the other, though somehow unified in their mutual effort to test the courage of these particular lads, for neither did the presence of the boys go unnoticed by the creatures. Throughout their clashes, either beast would alternately turn to look directly into the panicky eyes of the young beholder, as if in evaluation of the audience of their horrifying display. Their bright red, laser-like eyes penetrating deep within the darkest chambers of the youth's innermost soul, inflicting the paralyzing sting of frozen panic, a chilling leer of enormous gleaming incisors enhanced the evil encounters. Those spoken words were not wrought. A fiendish, presumably telepathic message of terror was transmitted. A message to keep silent. Until now, each of the boys had kept that silence, fearful to speak the truth, lest the consequence be lethal. Having now dared to confront the fear together, had effect to integrate the three and to bolster their collective courage. They resolved to share the next ghastly affair that unquestionably would come that very night. As the night wore and the conversation waned, the boys' determination to solve the mystery and confront their fear weakened. And yet, it had to be done. The cloak of secrecy that had shielded them thus far was secret no more. It was as if speaking about the encounters had destined them to this inevitable, terrible confrontation. They were afraid. They also knew that further postponement would change nothing. And so it was, with reluctant resolve, that they climbed back through the window to await the unavoidable occurrence in the dark, shadowy. Close together, with their backs against the headboard of the old bed, the quilt pulled tightly under their chins, the boys waited for more than an hour, not once hearing an unusual sound. They started to relax, and began to believe that perhaps the menacing visit would not come after all. Not able to keep their eyes open any longer, soon after, they each drifted off to sleep. Sometime deep into the overnight hours, the youngest of the three heard the first sound. The heavy shuffling of a pair of monstrous feet dragging across the hardwood floor. Another pair closely followed the first. Trembling with terror, he nudged his brothers, one either side awake. "They're here," he whispered. Indeed they were. The unmistakable sounds of the beast clashing from across the room were clear, the rough and tumble wrestling distinct. All three of the boys now quivered beneath the quilt, afraid to look, but knowing too that they had to defy their fear, challenge the creatures. Recognizing that he had the duty to lead by example, the oldest brother led his younger brothers in a mouthed countdown from three. 3, 2, 1, look! The boys pulled the quilt from over their heads, though just barely, and stared in the direction of the toy chest, which seemed always to be the center of the ghastly activity. There before them stood the gruesome duo, upper limbs locked together, thrashing and rocking about, each testing the strength of the other. The equally matched fiends paused in their struggle, one against the other, to take notice of the three boys, and the unprecedented, bold move that they had made. Seemingly surprised, though not unsettled by the young men's daring bravado. the eyes of the monsters locked onto those of the three. Burning, wicked eyes that raged with a mixture of orange, red, and yellow, penetrating to the very marrow of the terrified trio. Wholly aware that the attention of the brutes was now focused fully on them, the petrified boys ducked back under the protective quilt, pulling it ever tighter over their heads. "This isn't real. It can't be," said Iotis. "It's real enough for me," exclaimed the middle brother. The youngest emphatically nodded his agreement. Trying to convince his younger siblings that it could not be actual monsters that they had seen, the oldest and bravest brother ordered them to look again. For the second time, he mouthed a countdown. 3, 2, 1, look! Once more, they pulled back the quilt, and yet again, the brutes were visible before the boys. Only now, they had closed the distance between them and the bed by half. The fiery cauldron that was the eyes of the beast bubbled and boiled in an ever-increasing fury. Menacing extremities that could only pass as arms, reaching toward the three, vicious daggers of teeth snarling and lashing at the night. The horrifying scene shocked the boys, and they sat there in frozen, mind-numbing silence. The only sound that either could hear was the forceful pounding of their own hearts, hammering in their throats and ears. Screaming, screaming, and screaming! Yet no sound could be heard. The intensity of terror was so complete that the very vocal cords of the three boys were constricted and squeezed tight. Instinctively, they recoiled and retreated within the defensive boundaries of the old quilt yet again. As the quaking trio clustered tightly under their shield, each clinging to the other in an attempt to cloak themselves and their brothers from harm, the ghouls advanced. Closer, closer, and ever more closer they came. And although the light in the room was meager, it was enough to cast the threatening shadows of the demons on the umbrella of the quilt just above their heads, looming large now, just inches away. The violent shaking and trembling of the boys caused the now too small bed to shudder beneath them, bucking wildly up, down, and sideways. Then again, it may have been the weight of the beast on the bed advancing further still that caused the forceful movement. None can now know, for it was at that very moment that the panic reached its zenith. A terrible twisting of reality and unbearable nightmarish images swirled around and around in an ever-shrinking cyclone of pinwheel clusters, distorting their vision, encircling them in a tunnel of darkness. Sometime much later, shivering and drenched with sweat, the boys regained groggy consciousness. Their young bodies were exhausted, every muscle sore and aching. Dazed and confused, they surveyed their surroundings. The early morning sunshine illuminated the room, revealing the hellish truth of the night just past. Spread throughout the room was the most extensive chaos that they had yet awakened to. Every item of the three was strewn about the floor, the dresser laying face down, and the toy chest emptied, its contents scattered. The bed, which had been their safe haven, angled sharply away from the wall, leaving no doubt that the nighttime visitation had been real. There was an area of the disheveled room that was clear, though. One area approximately 3 feet squared that contained no piece of clothing, no wayward toy. However, it was not truly empty, for there in the center of this ring-like space were the two plastic figurines, their upper limbs entwined as if engaged in a great fight to the finish. As the boys picked up the tremendous jumble, they knew that no words need be spoken between them. each had experienced the most evil of nightmares together. Their thoughts, fears, and resolve were now as one, and the discord that they may have had vanished with the breaking dawn. All three knew that they must work jointly to purge the foul presence that had invaded their home, and they knew that they must do so before another night drew near, as they could not endure even one more night of the ghoulish entity's indescribable taunting. It was obvious to them now that the two figurines that they had found on their first day in this new house was the source of this malevolent presence. The boys had to find a way to destroy the creatures lest they themselves be destroyed, but all three were fearful of handling them. Using a mismatched sock whose mate had long since vanished, the oldest brother gathered the entangled pair, depositing them in a shoebox. It occurred to the boys to burn the beasts in a raging fire, and yet, if these demons were from the very pits of hell themselves, perhaps the flames would prove inconsequential. Moreover, the parents forbade any of the three from involvement with matches. Therefore, one logical alternative remained. The creatures must be returned to the cursed ground from which they had come. The boys were hopeful that the burying of the fiends would fracture the blight which had besieged their family, and peace would be restored. Success was only partial, for while the entombment of the brutes deep within the mound of the side yard ceased the nocturnal visitations to the boys, it did nothing to subside the abnormal activities experienced by any of the others. The story closes on a small open platform of an Amtrak station in Aurora, Colorado. The year is 1966. The month is June. The mother and her six children board an eastbound train, bound for Detroit, bound for home. The husband follows by car, racing to leave behind the peculiar goings-on that had so plagued his family and the dream he had to conquer the West. During a cross-country trip many years later, the middle of the three brothers drove by the old haunted house while passing through Denver, eager to see if it were still standing and the bare dirt mound of the side yard was still visible. Passing by slowly, he could see that both the house and the mound were still there, seemingly unchanged. His sweating palms and brow indicated to him that the curse of the creatures may still be present, buried, but perhaps not deep enough to prevent a resurrection. He prayed that the current family would leave the mound undisturbed, fearing that the evil incarnate of his youth might otherwise subjugate another family to the trauma survived by he and his brothers. So, if you live in a Denver suburb, or any other for that matter, and the house you occupy be not your own, pay attention to the sights and sounds of your dwelling. If your children or siblings come to you with a tale of inconceivable horror, do not be so quick to dismiss their apprehension with a wave of the hand, for you may not know the evil history of your home. Take heed, my friends, lest you find yourselves in a horrifying situation where your mind screams the question,
"Woman!"